with the Prayer Amps Quest number 153. In this podcast, we're looking at a fairly old flagship device, but surprisingly, not that much has been done on them yet, at least not much that is freely available. So the flagship device is a gurney flap, and these have been around since at least the 70s, and it's been an age since they've been invented. And they're a little counterintuitive, because if you look at them, they don't really look like most aerodynamic devices out there. They are literally just this vertical flat plate at the trailing edge of an airfoil. And because they are so blunt and the airfoils are so sleek, you wouldn't expect them to behave so well. They're kind of chalk and cheese. But they do behave so well. They do complement each other so well. But the interesting thing is that not much work has been done on them in terms of how they are positioned and their location. So in this podcast, we're going through not only how they behave, but also the different positions of them, and both when they are a little more towards the leading edge and in their angles. So they can either be vertically down or positioned at a little bit of an angle. And we're seeing how these affect the airfoil's performance in terms of the lift and drag. So this is a cool study, because usually we just assume that we put the gurney flap right at the back of the airfoil at the trailing edge and vertical, but that isn't necessarily what is best, or maybe it is. I don't know. We haven't gone through the podcast yet, so we're going to find out. What's more, they are heavily used on helicopters as well, so that's not what you'd expect, but it is a scientific fact. Just like peanut butter and apple go great together, this is also true where gurney flaps and helicopter blades go well together as well. So, these researchers of this paper, which is called, I'll scroll up a little bit, and you can find it in the link in the description as well. This paper is called Computational Investigation on the Effects of Gurney Flap on Airfoil Performance. So these researchers are aiming to do the first systematic review on how gurney flap's position and mounting angle affects the airfoil's lift-drag and lift-drag ratio. They also look at one other variable, which we'll also cover. I'll leave that as a little bit of a surprise later on. So to do this computational study, they are looking at a NACA 0012 airfoil, which, if you don't know the definition of a NACA airfoil or this terminology, check out our YouTube video called Aero Fundamentals number 16, Airfoil Nomenclature Explained. It's a good one, even if I do say so myself. And once you watch that, you'll understand what I mean by saying like NACA 0012, for example. So they are also looking at this study with CFD, which kind of makes sense these days, because I don't see too many experiments going on anymore, which is a shame, because these days, back in my day, everything was experiments. Well, actually not, I'm not that old, but still I do like experiments as much as CFD. But in this study, they're looking at using RANs, at least that is what I can deduce from their CFD setup. In fact, their CFD setup, which they describe, is a little lacking in terms of details. We'll go through it and I'll point out what is good, what is bad, and what really needs to be included instead, but you'll see what I mean. So in figure 2, we see close-ups of the trailing edge of the airfoil in this like green line, and then these gurney flaps coming down. So we have this gurney flap down at an angle, vertical down here, then we have it at an angle down here, and we have it more towards the leading edge compared to the trailing edge. And you have the normal airfoil without these gurney flaps. It has a crisp trailing edge. Then these gurney flaps are added on to potentially change the flow physics, which we'll see why. So one thing that I really don't like about this paper is that the authors just say that the CFD is validated. And if you want to see the validation, you need to read another paper. So this doesn't really make much sense, and it's bad practice for a research article, because everything that's like pertinent, that is vital to the paper, should be added into the paper, saying like a vital piece of information is somewhere else. That's just lazy work. So anyway, for example, they say that the K-epsilon RNG terminus model that they used for this CFD is adequate, but that is highly questionable in this particular situation, because at this point the boundary layer is very important, and the K-epsilon RNG model doesn't do a good job with it generally. Like the K-epsilon model, it relies on having quite a high Y plus value, so that means you're not really resolving the boundary layer very much. We'll get into that in a second. That also means that the K-epsilon RNG model may or may not be very good, and like that's a question that you should be answering in this paper by giving information about your CFD setup and the validation process, not just saying, oh yeah, it's validated and blah blah blah. So what's also interesting is that they also go to all the trouble of writing out the K-epsilon RNG equations, which you can find pretty much in any CFD textbook, but they don't give the CFD validation data, which is far more important to see here. So it's almost like they're going out of their way not to show their CFD validation data. So from the information that they give here about their CFD, I'm going to say that their CFD is like a 3 out of 10. But let's move on. So the Reynolds number based on the F4 Chord is 2.1 million, which is a little more comforting because they are using the Capsilon RNG terminus model, which is not good at handling transitional flows. So with a Reynolds number this high, the flow will almost certainly be turbulent, which is better for the Capsilon RNG model. If it was more in like 200,000 or 300,000 Reynolds number, then the RNG Capsilon model would be even more questionable because that would really not really handle that nearly as well. So one interesting thing to note is that they say that they use under relaxation factors of 0.8. So what does that mean? Well, under relaxation is a way of helping an equation to hold true. For example, and this is very important for CFD because under relaxation is often used for a very important reason, which we'll get into in a second. I'm just going to explain what under relaxation first is and then why we use it. So for example, let's say we have the equation 1 + 1 = 2. We all know that, but this is a very rigid equation. You need exactly 1 plus exactly 1 to equal exactly 2. But what if you were to say, well, anything between 0.8 and 1.2 for both variables is fine. So you could say now 0.8 plus 0.8 equals 2. Now that obviously they don't, but because we said that there is a little bit of leeway, it's okay. So anything between 0.8 and 1.2, if you add them together, we'll get 2. Well, that leeway is the relaxation factor. And we're explicitly saying that these things don't have to add up exactly to the 2 or whatever the value is. They can be a little bit different. The lower the relaxation factor is, the more leeway there is, which means that we can have like 0.1 or 0.2 plus 0.2 equals 2. So that does make sense for us. But when you think about CFD, where we iterate through, that's actually very important. And we'll go through why now. So it is very standard for many CFD simulations to have a relaxation factor because it really helps with convergence. The reason is because when you first start your simulation, usually the initial conditions are way off the solution that you'll be getting. So you might say like the entire domain, the velocity might even be 0 meters per second. And the only thing that's really driving this is the inlet boundary condition saying that you have like a 10 meter per second inlet. And then that starts to iterate through and you get the solution. Well, if you don't really have a relaxation factor, then you're saying that from the very start, every equation needs to line up perfectly. So literally every cell needs to have the exact information that you need for the solution, which obviously doesn't make sense because you're running the CFD to get the solution. You can't have the solution before you find the solution, obviously. So that is difficult to do. So that's why we need this relaxation factor to help us solve these equations without the simulation crashing. So what that means is that these authors are using relaxation factors to help the solution converge. And that is important to understand because it sometimes also can mean that the CFD is not high quality, or it might just mean that the CFD is very complex. That these are both possible reasons. So that's the relaxation factor, and I wanted to talk about that because I think a lot of people don't know exactly what it does and why we use it, but it's very important. So let's move on. So another thing that I think we should also go through is figure 3, because this shows the mesh. And let me zoom in a little bit because it doesn't look like too much now, but let's, here we go. So the reason why I think we should go through what this picture shows us, is because when I first started doing CFD seriously, I didn't actually understand these pictures myself. So I remember sitting in like an office with my supervisor, looking at them, at like ones like this, and my supervisor being able to tell if the meshes were decent or not, at least generally speaking or not. And I had no idea what these pictures meant. Like they just looked like colors to me. And they may as well have just been like pictures of cats. But once I started looking at it and learning, they started to become more obvious. So in the middle of the airfoil, and that is denoted by this black shape, we actually have the airfoil. This is the airfoil here. There are no blue lines going through it. So this airfoil surface looks jagged if we zoom in even more. So we can see like this black region, the outline to it is jagged, but that's not because the boundary is jagged, it's just pixelation. At least that's what I assume, that's usually what happens. The surface should be very smooth. So we shouldn't really think about these jagged bits too much, that's just an artifact of the picture. But let's talk about these blue lines and what they are. So I've zoomed in here and we can see a little bit better what they mean. So I like this color because it's actually the Premier Aerodynamics signature color, but they also mean something else that's also important. So when we look away from the airfoil, we see all these little cells, so all these little squares, or more accurately, quadrilaterals, and these are the cells of the mesh. And this plane is literally a plane slicing through the mesh. So we're slicing this cross section and we're looking at this surface now that the cross section is revealing. As we move towards the airfoil, the blue lines just become one solid blue mass. So you can see here now it's just this blue smear. And this is because the cells are becoming so small that the line thickness it results in not being able to see the cells anymore. In fact, if we had their CFD set up and we were to zoom in more in their CFD, we would start seeing more and more of these tiny little cells. So there are still cells there, but you just can't really see them because they're just so small that the blue lines, the thicknesses of them are just converging together. So the only question remaining is, why do the solid blue areas look like this? This also cross pattern here as well in the trailing section. So this blue cross-sectional area, this like cross that we see, is partly a function of the mesh and partly a function of the software. Let's first look at the horizontal direction, so this way here. As we approach the airfoil from the front, the cells are very fine. This is good because at the leading edge, there is quite a lot of activity happening here. The flow has to move out of the way, and there's a stagnation point. So the flow physics is changing quite a lot. We want the cells very fine to pick up these changes in this region. So the model, and we want to model them correctly. So having fine cells here is very good. That's fine. That's why we get this really like blue smear here going over the airfoil. We also get really fine cells, and that is also great because that is where much of the small scale stuff is occurring, and we want to model these structures, generally speaking, because they greatly affect the flow and the performance of the airfoil. Then, when we get to the trailing edge, the cells are still really small. Well, it turns out that this is also great because in the trailing edge, we have the wake, and the wake is full of turbulent structures. Some of them will be adequately solved, and others won't. This is the nature of RANs. And we rely on the stochastic nature of RANs to model the important stuff, and then the unimportant stuff we sometimes use equations like these empirical equations or theoretical equations. Sometimes we just forget about them and say, well, they're not that important and let's continue. But either way, RANs does this, and it's usually not great, but oh well, that's how it is. So that is why the mesh is so fine in the trailing section. Now we get this part that is kind of inefficient, and that is the vertical blue line here. So we can see that it's going up and down. This vertical part is quite far away from anything important, including the flow feature. So we can see here, it's really far away from the trailing edge, it's far away from the airfoil. There's not really much that's going to be happening here. But sometimes it happens because of the mesh setup, and also it's because of the mesher that you use. For example, it might have occurred because the researchers had different refinement zones, and there's an interface between two that ISEM, which is the measure that they used, decided to make the cells finer. So you have one refinement zone, another front refinement zone where they meet, then that interface sometimes triggers this problem where we get really fine cells between them, and that's what we may be getting here. However, because they used ISEM, I know from experience using ISEM, it was actually just from the software, because you want the trailing edge refinement as we have here. And you get this vertical line too, unfortunately. It kind of just comes with the territory. They're just wasted cells because of the mesher. And so these simulations take longer because we have additional cells here which we don't need. I never really solved how to get rid of this in ISEM. I actually just went to a different mesher because there was a lot about ISEM I didn't like. And from what I can tell, you can't really fix that in ISEM. But anyway, we have this artifact here. And I want to discuss what this figure means and why we get these different artifacts. So hopefully you found that enlightening. So that is the CFD setup, at least what they reported on. Let's move to the results. But if you like this podcast or want to see more like this, please subscribe. And now onto the results. So in figure 4, we see the effect of different gurney flap heights on the lift coefficient. This is when the gurney flap is at the trailing edge of the airfoil and completely vertical, so not angled and not moving towards the leading edge at all. Now, I know that in the introduction I said that we are looking at the gurney flap angle and position, and I didn't mention anything about its height, but we're also looking at this anyway because it's a nice little Easter egg for us. So straight away, we see that increasing the gurney flap height, so literally how much it juts out, it greatly improves the lift coefficient. For example, with no gurney flap, which is the black solid line, like the black solid squares with the dashed line going between them, that's with no gurney flap. Let's say at 4 degrees, which is a fairly high cruise angle attack, the lift coefficient is a decent 0.4, so about here. But when you put a fairly large gurney flap on it, so 4% of the cord, so the gurney flap is 4% of the cord length, like down, the lift coefficient jumps to about 1.1, almost 200% more lift is being produced, which is this point here. That is how effective gurney flaps are at increasing an airfoil's lift coefficient. As I mentioned earlier, they don't look like much, but they're very effective. However, these gains in the lift coefficient, at least, are not linear. So here, this was for the gurney flap of 4% cord, which we got an almost 200% increase in lift coefficient. But when we have a gurney flap of only 1% cord, so this red solid circle with the dashed line here, when we have this 1% cord, so only a tiny gurney flap in comparison, the lift coefficient still rises at 4 degrees to 0.7, which is a 50% increase over the non-gurney flap situation. So that that's more than expected if the relationship between the gurney flap size and the lift coefficient was linear, which is not obviously, because we're getting significantly more lift than what we expected. What this means is that as far as the lift coefficient goes, as the gurney flap size increases, the new lift coefficient gains aren't as great. There's this point of like limiting, like no return, like it's a diminishing returns, I mean. Not no return, that's more a space thing. But anyway, a point where you get diminishing returns, where increasing the gurney flap doesn't seem to be increasing the lift as much. But is that a bad thing? Well, that's only half the story. What about the drag coefficient? Because it's all well and good to get an improved lift coefficient, but if that comes at a terrible drag coefficient, then that's not so great. So let's see how the gurney flap size affects the drag coefficient, which we see in figure 5 here. We get an interesting result. So for the 40 degree angle attack, which we were looking at before, which is this line here, where we have no gurney flap, the drag coefficient is about 0.016. Then when we add a 1% gurney flap, which is this red dot here, which is sort of covered as well, the drag coefficient jumps to about 0.02, so about a 25% increase. On the other hand, the 4% gurney flap, which is about here, sees a drag coefficient of about 0.04, so a 150% increase. So that means that for both extremes of the gurney flap, the lift and drag ratios increase, so regardless of whether it's like 1% gurney flap or 4% gurney flap or anything in between, but the increase was better for the smaller gurney flap. That makes sense because the gurney flap is so bluff that it really disturbs the flow, and you can really understand how too big a gurney flap would greatly spoil the flow. So in figure 8, we also see some path lines which help us understand what the flow is doing around these gurney flaps. Now this is at an angle attack of 10 degrees, which is like a very high angle attack for cruise, like you wouldn't have this ever. It would be more for like takeoff or like a transitional sort of phase or whatever. So if you don't know what a path line is, check out our YouTube video called Aero Fundamentals Number 9, Differences Between Streamlines, Streak Lines, and Path Lines. Then you understand what I mean here with path lines. They're very different to streak lines and streamlines. When it's transient, when it's steady, there's a lot more similarities between them. But if you want to learn more about it, check that video out. Anyway, as expected, as the gurney flap height increases, so we get no gurney flap, bit of a gurney flap, more and even more. So as it increases, it disturbs the flow more and more, as you'd expect, even to the point where this little vortex on the upstream side forms in this crevice. So I'll zoom in here a little bit. That's a bit too much, maybe. Here we go. Okay, so we can see this little vortex forming right here in this crevice, which we don't get really as much for these other situations. So that's not great. Downstream, there is quite a big wake forming, which is to be expected, and that is where the additional drag comes from. That's like a pressure drag that we're seeing, really. But what about the additional lift? Where's that coming from these gurney flaps? Well, the path lines also show us where the additional lift is coming from, and if you see the angle, you will see that when we have the gurney flap, the path lines are angled down more and more. So when we have no gurney flap, these bottom path lines and even the top ones are kind of going up at an angle a little bit. With a little bit of a gurney flap, they go down a little bit, a bit more, and even more here. So you can see here, all these streamline, or these path lines I should mention, are all going down for this very big gurney flap. So that tells us that, okay, that's why we are getting so much more lift being produced. There's this gurney flap really directing this flow down, and that's where this additional lift is coming from. So let's move on to the effects of the gurney flap position on the aerodynamics. So whether putting it at the trailing edge or a bit more upstream or whatever affects the aerodynamics. So in figure 9, we see that moving the gurney flap more upstream, away from the trailing edge, results in less lift being produced at high angle tack, so up here. But at low angle tack, the differences are minimal. So that means that when we have the gurney flap upstream or whatever, at low angle tack, it doesn't really make much of a difference. It's only at high angle tack when we get sort of the stall rate regime. But when we go to low angle tack for the drag coefficient, we see that the gurney flap being upstream more is actually bad for it. So even though we don't get much of a change in the lift coefficient, the gurney flap being upstream increases the drag quite a bit, which is not good. So it's safe to say that as a general rule, that moving the gurney flap upstream of the trailing edge is bad for aerodynamics because we don't really benefit the lift too much, but we do get a drag penalty. Worst of both worlds, we don't really want that. And figure 12 shows that the path lines when the gurney flap, the path lines of the gurney flap look at different positions. As expected, moving it further upstream creates a greater wake. So you can see here with a little bit of wake, more wake, and even greater wake. And that interacts with the rear portion of the airfoil, and that messes with the airfoil's pressure side, and that of course is going to affect the lift production and potentially in a negative way. This is an angle attack of 12 degrees, that's why we saw that drop off. What about the gurney flap's angle though? So we know now that putting it more upstream doesn't make much of a difference. Changing its height does make quite a big difference. We know that changing its height, increasing it, is better for lift, but we'll get that drag penalty, so it's sort of like a sweet spot there. What about changing its angle though? How does that affect the airfoil's performance? Well, I'm glad you asked. So in figure 13, this shows that at low angle attack, changing the gurney flap angle has almost no effect on the lift. You might argue that deviating from 90 degrees, so vertical, reduces the lift a little bit, but that could very well be just error in the CFD, given how small the changes are, and also we don't really know about the CFD, how good it is. To be perfectly honest, they skipped out a lot of that data, so I wouldn't really trust these lower values anyway. Once we start to get to higher angle attack, then okay. But anyway, at high angle attack, we really can't conclude much anyway either. Perhaps the only thing that is that when the gurney flap is at 30 degrees, so quite horizontal, quite shallow, the lift coefficient drops by about 5 or 10%. That's not much considering just how much the gurney flap has changed angle. Now, figure 16 gives us a good idea of why. So, it shows us these path lines, and we can see that while different vortices occur depending on the flap angle, the angle at which the path lines are directed down at are almost identical regardless of whether the gurney flap is vertical, 45 degrees, 120 degrees, whatever. So no wonder the lift coefficient isn't really affected by the gurney flap too much. The gurney flap isn't really affecting the production with these path lines. But what about the drag coefficient? So figure 14, this one here, shows us that it is almost completely unaffected by the gurney flap angle. In other words, the drag coefficient is, I'm quite surprised here, is not really affected by the gurney flap angle. In fact, the only thing that is clear is that having a gurney flap is bad for drag. So you can see here this hollow square icon is always lower than all the other icons, and there when we have gurney flaps. So apart from the flap angle that has almost no effect, the actual drag is fairly similar. So I'm a little surprised at these results. I thought that the flap angle might have had more of an effect, but particularly on the drag coefficient, but nope, that's good to know though. So that brings us to the end of the podcast, My Little Aerodynamicists. I really liked it because there were so many very particular results, but also not very expected ones either as well. So I do like a good twist to a storyline, don't you? So if you like this podcast, make sure to hit the like button, and if you want to see more like this, click the subscribe button, and or the follow button, depending on which platform you're listening to this on and watching it on. And if you want to get better at aerodynamics and or CFD, check out our courses in the link in the description. And if you want to make your experiments 2 to 4% more accurate, get yourself an Amazon Hawk. It's an instrument we make to make your experiments 2 to 4% more accurate because it measures the density of air. And the density of air is important because it changes every day by 2 to 4%, and even more between days, weeks, months, and seasons. And the reason why is because the density of air is affected by the barometric pressure, temperature, and humidity. And even you just being around in your wind tunnel affects these parameters. So let's say, for example, you get in the morning and it's a fairly crisp day or whatever. We all know that it's actually kind of like that now, transitioning into crisp days. And the temperature in your wind tunnel and the barometric pressure and humidity are all one thing. and you're in there, you sort of like talking, working, moving around. You're pumping out heat, water from your breath and speaking. And then you come back after lunch and the day's heated up a little bit, and that's going to change the temperature in your wind tunnel as well as the barometric pressure and humidity. That then changes the density of air. And between like months, this could be even 10 or 15%. So having even 2 to 4% changes, that's really bad, because a lot of the data that we find, the changes of like even less than that. So we are looking at these changes, which are then engulfed in error, and we can't really tell anything. And then what's even worse, we often use this data to validate our CFD, and that's not going to work. Like these guys, I think, probably had craps validation data or validation process, but that's for one reason, I don't know why. But if you don't have density of air measured, then you're going to have crap validation data as well, and you need to have the right density of air in your CFD to match your experiments. And even just not having the right density in your experiments changes the velocity, for example. So the Atmosphere Hawk has figured that error for you, and you can find the instrument in the link in the description. And I'll see you next video. Peace out, amigos.